Most of you here, if not all, are aware of the Hans Küng case and would be interested, I'm sure, in how another Catholic theologian might analyze it. And then all of you are concerned as fellow Christians with the larger question of what does it mean to be a Catholic? How do contemporary Catholics understand that question, and how do they go about trying to answer it? I'm, besides being chairman of theology at Notre Dame, I'm also have the Crowley O'Brien Walter Chair of Theology. It sounds like an Irish law firm, but I'm going to be formally installed in that chair on October 17th. And the presentation that I'm going to make here today is not in absolutely final form. You're going to see me fussing around here and trying to get the scissors and paste right now. It'll be eventually in final form. It'll be almost the same as this, unless I find out that something just isn't accurate, and you'll let me know before I go. It'll be published in a booklet by Notre Dame, and if you're interested in getting a copy, you can always write and ask for it. I'm sure they'll send you a copy, or write to me if you can't get anywhere with the administration there. If you're writing for football tickets, you'd have a problem, but I'm sure they'll have extra copies of my talk. I begin this final presentation with two regrets. As Walt knows, I had a previous lecture commitment in Massachusetts before he invited me to come here last year. And I could accept this invitation only on condition that I did not withdraw from my previous commitment to the other the Religious Education Conference in the Diocese of Springfield, Massachusetts. And because of that commitment, and because, let's face it, this is far removed, I'm used to being 30 minutes from an airport and having a telephone and all that. Because of this difficulty and time required to get in and out of here, I have to leave early this afternoon. And I feel especially keenly the lost opportunity of celebrating the Eucharist together with you all tonight. And I want you to be assured that I really shall be with you in spirit and in the literal meaning of the word Eucharist, that I too shall be giving thanks for the blessings of these days together in hope that the celebration tonight, my presence being unfortunately only a kind of a spiritual presence, that it will be an opportunity also to recommit ourselves to that call to work and pray for Christian unity. A second regret that I have is a reference to this presentation, is that there is no second fireside opportunity for me following this presentation, because although we had a full and vigorous discussion last night, there are questions which are going to be raised by this paper as well, that I'm sure some of you would like to present. And I would learn, I'm sure, very much from your questions and from your reaction to my answers. There are questions here, and as I'm going through, I may make some marginal remarks. That's as opposed to shout like hell, arguments weak. When I mean marginal remarks, I mean get off the text and try to, in a sense, put myself in your shoes and say, now, how is this sounding? And I'll make some comments, because you're going to wonder, is Roman Catholic, why don't I use the adjective Roman? And, some people say there are more Catholics than Roman Catholics. Well, that's true. But on the other hand, there is a problem with the adjective Roman, for me at least, and for other Catholics. It's one thing to be in communion with the See of Rome for reasons which, is in the Lutheran Catholic dialogues, by the way. But it's quite another to use the adjective Roman to qualify a noun like Catholicism, because Roman Catholicism can also give the impression which we Catholics, you regard maybe as Roman Catholics, do not want to accept, that Catholicism means it's a form of Christianity which is dictated culturally, spiritually, theologically, and every other way, politically, canonically, by the prevailing mores, the prevailing spirit in the Diocese of Rome or in the Vatican. And that really is inconsistent with Catholicism, even in its most traditional, quotes, Roman sense. So in this regard, I do agree, and this will come up in the text, I do agree with Hans Küng's criticisms of Romanism, But I, for now, you'll see it in the text. I don't agree with him in the way he relates Catholicism and Catholicity and so forth and so on. But anyway, there are questions there. I'm sure you'd like to raise them. I can't just, we don't have the opportunity. I mean, we can always build a fire after the talk, and I could stay about 10 minutes, but that won't be quite the thing. And so the most I can do with my back to the wall and shame completely gone, because I am so confident in the final forgiveness of sins, there is in fact a source available which you might consult after I depart. This presentation will move constantly, and I hope not confusingly, between the general and the particular. It is concerned with the general issue of Catholic identity as a theological problem in its own right, and with the Hans Küng controversy as a particular case in point. So my presentation is on Catholic identity, what does it mean to be Catholic, and the Hans Küng case is used as a point of reference to discuss the larger issue. The paper addresses six specific questions, each of which touches inevitably upon both the general and the particular aspects of today's topic. First, are there limits to Catholic orthodoxy? Secondly, who sets those limits? Thirdly, by what process are those limits identified and safeguarded? Fourthly, what criteria govern the decision or judgment which emerges from the process? Fifthly, what can be said about Hans Küng's answer to the question of Catholic identity? And sixthly, what sort of answer to the question of Catholic identity might usefully complement and or correct Hans Küng's answer? So the paper is framed then by six questions. First, are there limits to Catholic orthodoxy? Secondly, who sets those limits? Thirdly, by what process are those limits identified and safeguarded? Fourthly, what criteria govern the decision or judgment which emerges from the process? Fifthly, what can be said about Hans Küng's answer to the question of Catholic identity? And sixthly, what sort of answer to the question of Catholic identity might usefully complement and or correct Hans Küng's answer? Now, obviously, these questions I'll be repeating because I'm going to be treating each one in sequence. You'll readily understand, I trust, that each of these questions merits a paper of its own. I have, for example, already addressed myself to the first question, are there limits to Catholic orthodoxy, in an article which appeared in the Jesuit Weekly America magazine, March 3, 1980, and the article of mine was The Limits to Orthodoxy. It's part of a special issue called Heresy Today. I think it had a question mark after it. But I recommend that issue if you're interested. Avery Dulles had a piece in there by the same title, Heresy Today. Richard McCormick, the Catholic moral theologian, has a piece in there. Charles Curran, John Cameron, and I don't know, I think there may have been one other contributor, but there's about five contributors. It's worth getting hold of it. You can get special issues of America just by writing to them. The March 3rd, 1980. And I have a piece in there called The Limits to Orthodoxy. But given the limitations of this morning's paper, I cannot hope to do more than outline an answer to each of the six questions or suggest the direction each answer might take. First question, are there limits to orthodoxy? And before I can even begin answering the question, I've got to anticipate one of your questions. You know, isn't there more than orthodoxy at issue? Isn't there also orthopraxy? Of course. But that isn't what I'm talking about here. It's true. It's not enough that we have right doctrine, or literally right praise. We also have to have right practice. And you can have people who are, at least on paper, orthodox, so orthodox they squeak. But in terms of orthopraxy, the gospel is not, in a sense, credibly echoed in their lives. And the whole question of social justice and human rights and all the rest, so the reason I'm not raising it here is not that it's irrelevant to the general question, but it's irrelevant to the particular question I'm talking about here. I don't think, frankly, that the issue the Hans Kuhn case raises is an issue over orthopraxy. It's an issue over orthodoxy. But I'm admitting from the very beginning there is a larger agenda that we have to face. And I said earlier, I said last night that that's one of the challenges to all the bilaterals, and the Lutheran Catholic in particular, is to move eventually from the doctrinal issues to the ethical issues, because that's where the orthopraxy dimension is that will be joined. So, there are limits to orthodoxy. That's my basic first thesis, answering the first question. Are there limits to orthodoxy? In this case, Catholic orthodoxy. My answer is yes, there are limits to orthodoxy. It is evidently, at least to me, evidently, a matter of not a matter of indifference whether Christians, not to say Catholics, believe in God, in the Lordship of Jesus, in the redemptive significance of the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, in the mystery of the Church, in the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, or in the demand that we love our neighbor as we love ourselves, and so forth. It's not a matter of indifference. There have to be limits. I mean, one cannot affirm and deny the Lordship of Jesus and still be taken on the same basis as a member of the body of Christ, it seems to me. It's not, therefore, a matter of indifference. So on a point as central as that, obviously, there have to be some limits. Otherwise, one can no longer be recognized or accepted as a fellow Christian. Now, the point is that this issue of limits to orthodoxy, as you all know, is not only a Catholic problem. And as you all know, in a very special way. I quote from the January 16th issue of the Christian Century, an article by Richard Neuhaus. Protestant indignation over the Kuhn case should be tempered by the knowledge that most of our churches have not been notably successful in resolving the questions the Vatican congregation is designed to address. The questions have to do quite simply and complicatedly with communal identity. Of any significant community, it must be asked, how does the community define itself, and who is authorized to represent the community formally to those outside it? The community that can make no distinction between its own self-understanding and the individual opinions of the many who belong to it is not a significant community. If a United Methodist theologian publicly supported apartheid, condemn the ordination of women as unbiblical, and question the validity of communion without real wine, the United Methodist would no doubt find a way to indicate that the theologian did not represent the position of the church body. The Kuhn case is no occasion for Protestant smugness, continuing with Neuhaus. Rome has no monopoly on officialdoms that would smother dissent. And how many of us have worked through the ways in which the theological craft is or is not accountable to a community of faith? We, too, have various understandings of scriptural authority and of a legitimate development of tradition that make it possible to specify what is outside the community's pale. And then the final line, which I like very much, if we don't, we affirm everything and thus represent nothing. So, therefore, it seems to me, in answer to the first question, it has to be taken as a given, as something that we accept from the start, that there are limits to orthodoxy, Christian orthodoxy in general, to Catholic orthodoxy in particular, and therefore, it is not simply unthinkable that Hans Kuhn or any other Catholic theologian might, unwittingly or not, slide beyond the limits of orthodoxy and, in effect, be doing theology in a way other than Catholic. And so my first thesis, my first in answering the first question, I'm obviously tilting against my brothers and sisters to my left, who would say, how preposterous in this day and age for a Vatican congregation to be condemning a Catholic theologian. It's not preposterous in principle. I may not agree with the decision or the process. But for someone to say it's unthinkable, how unmodern, then you're back to the question. I mean, are there limits or not to Christian orthodoxy? Are there limits or not to the orthodoxy of particular communion? I mean, orthodoxy not in the sense of who's right with God and who isn't, but orthodoxy even in a pragmatic sense of who can be understood as faithfully representing a tradition, and then in the larger ecumenical process, the traditions which then can come together and really enrich the other traditions. I mean, some people think naively, I'm not speaking for anybody in particular, but some people have thought, let's put it that way, naively, that ecumenism means sitting down with brothers and sisters in the body of Christ, and trying to adopt as readily as possible the theological and doctrinal coloration of the other side, so that the Lutheran would think very nicely of the Catholic if the Catholic sounded Lutheran and kind of soft-pedaled what was regarded historically as traditionally Catholic emphases, and vice versa. Well, the Lutheran, as you could testify, or the Catholic, as I could testify, would say, well, it's all very nice. We're glad that you basically are one with us. Now, could we send out for a Catholic so that we could get some sense of how the tradition is mediated today? And the Catholic would say, could we get another Lutheran who is a little bit more conversant with and much more of an insider to the Lutheran theological and doctrinal and spiritual tradition, so that we really can enter into a dialogue and be enriched by it, and not simply hear an echo or look into a mirror. The second question, who sets those limits? Who sets those limits? Again, I lean against the wind to my left. There are liberal Catholics who believe that the only people who should set limits to orthodoxy for theologians are other theologians. Ecclesiologically, that is, it seems to me, unconscionable. I mean, another case of where liberals oftentimes use the theology of the right to defend supposedly liberal views. The church is the whole people of God. Theology serves the church. Therefore, in some way, the whole people of God must hold the theological community accountable for the way in which it reflects upon and articulates, critically so, the faith that the community shares and the faith which that community fundamentally and totally is responsible for proclaiming and living by. So in the answer to the second question, I'm saying I'm going to formulate my answer in terms somewhere between two extremes. The extreme left, which says that the only people who should evaluate a theologian's work are the theologian's peers, or no one at all, which is even more extreme position, or the extreme right, which says that the hierarchy alone should decide, the Pope and the bishops should decide when a theologian or theologians have drifted beyond the limits of orthodoxy. Theologians are not, now to press into the second question. Theologians are not without accountability to the church at large. The work of theologians is so intimately linked with the understanding, articulation, and exercise of the faith that it simply has to be evaluated by others who have the pastoral care of the church as their ministerial duty. But these others are not only the Pope and the bishops, although they have a different kind and degree of authority than, let us say, religious educators, campus ministers, liturgical directors, social action ministers, even pastors, and so forth. All of those who have positions of leadership in the church have to measure and test the work of theologians against the needs and situation of those whom these leaders serve and with whom they live and work as members of the church. They test the theologian's work not only to make sure it is orthodox, but also to satisfy themselves that it really connects with the faith and experience of their communities. Some orthodox theologies are practically useless. They speak in a doctrinally correct language, but the language is unintelligible to its intended audience. These theologies often answer questions that people no longer have, or which do not touch their lives, and are silent in the face of questions which people do have and which enter the core of their everyday lives. But what about the other side of the problem? What if, in fact, the orthodoxy and not just the relevance or intelligibility of a particular theological position is in doubt? Does not the church, meaning the whole people of God, also have a stake in truth, in clarity of understanding, in purity of faith? Of course it does. Why else did the church spill so much of its blood over the great Christological controversies of the 4th and 5th centuries, for example? The church knew that if Jesus Christ were not truly divine, were not truly God, a very God, then he could not have saved us. And at the same time, if he were not truly human, then he was not really one of us, and we could have not been saved through him. Furthermore, the issue was so central to Christian, not to say Catholic, identity, that the unity of the church itself hung in the balance. It became a matter for ecumenical councils and no longer just for theological debate, which only underscores a point that Robert Bellah once made in a contribution to the Culture of Unbelief, that such arguments are rarely debates about truth, but almost always debates about order and unity. And I wouldn't agree with that position without nuancing it, but the point is well taken that theological debates, doctrinal debates, are not simply debates about the truth, about clarity of understanding. They are also debates which have an immediate effect on the unity of the community within which the conflict has emerged, or from which the conflict has emerged. Therefore, my conclusion to the second answer to the second question, who sets those limits? Therefore, it is not simply unthinkable that a Vatican congregation, rather than a committee of theologians, might exercise supervision over a Hans Kuhn. It's not that only theologians can do it, or the theologian is not. It's not unthinkable that it's possible that a theological position could be formulated in such a way, or a theological point of view, by a person having an international reputation and international influence, that some international body, not simply a diocesan body or a national body, would have to take account of the international dimension of the theological position and the influence. Third question, by what process are those limits identified and safeguarded and then applied? I raise the following questions now, not in a polemical spirit, but by way of offering a set of criteria by which the process of official supervision might be measured and even corrected. Did the congregation, we're talking now about the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, that's the Vatican agency which issued the censure in the name of the Pope, or with the approval of the Pope, did the congregation consult with theologians who are competent on the matters under scrutiny? So in asking these questions, obviously, I'm giving the criteria. So did the congregation consult with theologians who are competent on the matters under scrutiny? Were these other theologians of one school of thought only, or was it a genuinely representative sample of competent theologians, progressive as well as conservative? Was the theologian himself, and I'm using the masculine pronoun deliberately because we're talking about Hans Kuhn, but there are more than male theologians in the Catholic Church and others, was the theologian himself informed immediately thereafter of the concerns which had arisen about his work? One of my friends, who is an American theologian, whose name I won't mention, but you could probably guess, he's a well-known Catholic theologian, is under, he's exchanged correspondence with the Vatican. He discovered that the investigation of his work has gone into a second phase. The first phase, you're under investigation without knowing it, and the Vatican congregation appoints your lawyer. And as he told me on the phone there a few months ago, I assume my lawyer didn't do a very effective job because it went to the second phase, which means then you tell the person who's under investigation that he, in fact, is under investigation. So my question here, this is a question of due process, was the theologian informed immediately of the concerns which had arisen about his work so that he himself could be involved, or she, if it were someone other than Kuhn, could be involved right away and say, well, look, now, if you want to investigate this, fine. I mean, you could be a theological education for you all. But make, now be sure, don't miss the article I did in such and such, and don't just judge my Christology on this, because don't forget that book. See, that sort of thing. But if you're not even consulted, you have no way of having any input into that initial investigatory process. Was the theologian given an opportunity at once to collaborate in the initial stages of the investigation and to decide upon his own representative or representatives before the investigating agency? Why do we have to have someone appointed with whom the one under investigation may have no confidence, or in whom he may have no confidence? Were the concerns expressed clearly and in language that did not beg the question itself? The same friend of mine who finally got an interrogatory from the Vatican, they were couched in terms that already assumed a certain, in this case, neo-scholastic ecclesiology. And no matter how you if you answered the question, you were, in a sense, accepting the ecclesiological implications of the question. So he returned them without answering them, but with a statement saying that the questions were, for him, impossible to answer as framed, because any answer to them would automatically assume that he agreed with the definitions of terms like magisterium and the more limited definition of the noun church and so forth. Were there, in other words, theological assumptions in the questions put to the theologian which would themselves be challenged by other responsible and competent theologians? As Martin Marty said recently in one of his earlier lectures, that, you know, you ask a question, Gallup can ask a question one way and get one set of answers, and ask the same kind of question another way and get another set of answers. And that's why it's how one asks a question is already part of the process of probing for an answer. Did the theologian know in advance which persons would be sitting on his case? Edward Skillebakes, for example, whom I predict will come out much more triumphant than Hans Küng in his exchanges with the Vatican, for reasons I'll indicate later. Skillebakes found, he found out that this Jean Gallot of the Gregorian University was on his case. And a day or two before the first meeting of the investigating body with Skillebakes, Gallot was on Vatican radio denouncing Skillebakes' Christology. Now, we in the legally developed world understand that to be an obvious sign of judicial prejudice. And anyone sitting on a case who had made a statement like that in advance of the case would automatically be disqualified. Well, Gallot remained on there, but the publicity surrounding Gallot's terrible blunder helped Skillebakes, just as well that Gallot stayed on, because it made the whole proceeding look even less credible than otherwise it might have. Was the theologian informed of the identity of those bringing the complaints? Did the theologian have access to all the pertinent files of the case? Was the theologian guaranteed the right of counsel and the protection of public proceedings? Was there provision for appeal beyond the decision rendered? Those are questions which I think are also, which also in a sense contain criteria. If in fact we agree, as I have, that there are limits to orthodoxy and that a theologian's work is subject not just to the evaluation of his peers, but also to the judgment of the church in terms of authoritative leaders, depending upon the level at which the controversy breaks out, even at international level. Having granted that, one must move to the third point and insist that then the process that is finally employed in the investigative process, in the investigative enterprise, should be one that one can recognize as due process, where the rights of the individual and the dignity of the individual as a fellow Christian are respected. Here it seems the case against Hans Küng begins to weaken, not by reason of the deficiencies of the case itself necessarily, but by reason of the process employed in making the case. And to me it's irrelevant that the Vatican and Küng were in exchanging publicly and privately messages for 10 years. It isn't as if they gave Hans Küng 10 years. It's that there were just no agreement reached on the terms by which the final investigation and encounter would take place. Now, I'm not exempting Hans Küng from responsibility on this. There is a phrase in the document of censure which leaps out at me, at least, as being the most significant phrase in the whole document: contempt for the magisterium. And you have to understand, it's not just the Italian mind, but it's very much the Italian mind. It's the whole idea of the bella figura and the brutta figura. It's one thing for you to be doing something which the Vatican knows you are doing and shouldn't be doing. It's another thing for you to say, ha ha, I'm doing it. Because the Vatican knows there are many things going on that violate very significant and highly publicized Catholic disciplinary practice in many countries of the world. And they go on, and the Vatican knows they go on, and it's this benignly Roman approach to law. I mean, law is there as kind of an ideal. If you can meet it, fine. If you can't, don't worry about it. I mean, that's what John, when they came to I mean, the great progressive Pope John the 23rd issued a statement saying that all theology in seminaries, Catholic seminaries, had to be taught in Latin. Problem was, most Catholic seminary professors, as well as their students, couldn't use the language in anything but halting manner. And so this is a case where someone came to the Pope, Pope John, and said, this can't be done. And he said, well, if you can't do it, you don't do it. And now you may say, well, how do I know about that one? Well, that was generally noised abroad. But I'll tell you another case that's quite consistent with it, where a friend of mine who was studying canon law in Rome, the same time I was doing my theology, was at the Lateran University. And at the Veterum Sapientiae had just come out. That was the decree that everything had to be back in Latin. And this was John's concession to a cardinal friend of his, Cardinal Bacci, who had written a Latin dictionary. Ah, the vested interest of authors. The money. Anyway, this man came in and very, very serious. This was one of the Vatican congregation officials. That was the Lateran had, those were the professors, mainly were the leading people in the different agencies. And he came in and he announced the Veterum Sapientiae and said, from here on in, he said in Latin, from here on in, your doctoral dissertations must be written in Latin. Well, the Americans sat just frozen in horror, and others too, but the Americans in particular. And there was just, he said you could hear a pin drop. I mean, they were just thinking, adding on. I mean, that's another year of my life just to get the stuff into Latin without worrying about. Then the man looked up very seriously. He says, ooh, he says, but of course, if you can't do it, you can't do it. You do it in your own language. But you see, this is something that a lot of Catholics don't understand, and if they don't understand it, I'll bet a lot of you don't understand it. There's a big difference between the Roman and Anglo-Saxon approach to law in the Catholic Church. The people who have studied canon law in Rome come away. Some people say, well, that's a very cynical approach. No, it's a Roman approach to law. Law is a standard. If you can do it, fine. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could all do this? Like the law of the gospel. I'm not saying you don't bother, but I mean, no one is going to, you know, say, well, now you weren't perfect today. I mean, no one expects people to be perfect, but to try. And the same thing, but the Anglo-Saxon approach is, this is the law, it says we can't use bread that looks like bread, tastes like bread, smells like bread, swallows like bread, we don't use it. Well, naturally, if you're in a situation where it would cause pastoral difficulty, you've been doing it with real bread and so forth, don't make an issue, but don't get your picture in the paper saying, we have defied the Vatican, here we have the bread. Now, this is all back to a point which may seem frivolous. In a sense, King did that. It was very clear. It was a very public case, and he said, you know, I'll come if I have time. We'd like you to come to Rome. I'll come if I have time. You know, call me again. I'm busy. That's basically the attitude. So when they say contempt for the magisterium, you have to read Roman documents. They're much more, the reason why he was finally censured is less his views on papal infallibility or anything else, but it was the way in which he conducted the exchange with the Vatican over the 10 years. Edward Skillebakes, on the other hand, had the good grace to have what appeared to be a heart attack before his meeting. At least he appeared to be exhausted and he had to go for a rest. And I'm not counseling that if one wants to play the game. But the point is that Skillebakes knew that he was compromising to an extent. But he did. But he comes out the winner. His hierarchy is behind him. Cardinal Willebrands, whom you all know is the head of the Vatican Congregation, Secretariat for Ecumenical Affairs, and the Dutch hierarchy, except the two real strong conservatives in the hierarchy, they're behind him. That isn't true in West Germany. Granted, West German bishops are, the Catholic bishops there, are very conservative to begin with, but I think it's fair to say King didn't exactly cultivate that constituency over the years. And apparently he didn't even cultivate, apparently, the constituency in his own faculty. This is not to justify what they did. There's an article, as someone pointed out to me, and I've read it since, by, I think, John Carey in one of the August issues of Christian Century right next door, which is, you know, a very fine report on the whole scene at Tübingen with Hans Küng and the apparent reversal of seven of his colleagues who no longer support him and so forth and so on. Well, So what I'm saying here is that the case begins to weaken, not by reason of the deficiencies of the case itself, but by reason of the process employed in making the case, and that's, again, without prejudice to the fact that there can be blame on the other side as well in terms of style and mode. The fourth question is, what criteria should govern the decision? Assume we have due process. We still have to raise the question, how do you make the judgment? I mean, we want to do it honorably, but then you have to have criteria or standards by which to decide when, in fact, a Catholic theologian may have slipped, unwittingly or not, beyond the limits of Catholic orthodoxy. Even if the process were beyond criticism, the judgment itself would have to have been founded on clearly established criteria. The text itself of the Vatican Congregation's declaration shakes one's confidence in the wisdom, if not the justice, of the outcome. It is not clear, for example, what criteria the congregation was using in the declaration of censure when it decided that Kuhn can no longer be considered a Catholic theologian. Unquestionably, there is a difference between Catholic and non-Catholic theologians, but on what basis is the line of demarcation drawn? Are they, in fact, the same criteria which distinguish any Catholic from any other Christian? The Vatican text doesn't provide these criteria. In fact, the text tends to be vague and confusing on the matter. If Kuhn is no longer a Catholic theologian, why is he also no longer a Catholic? In other words, let's take the infallibility thing. If it is so essential to Catholic identity to believe in and to profess, say, the dogma of papal infallibility as taught by Vatican I, and assuming that Kuhn doesn't accept that and the charges that he doesn't, then why is it the declaration only that he is no longer a Catholic theologian and not that he is no longer a Catholic? Is it that Catholics could perhaps conceivably not accept the dogma of papal infallibility and still be Catholic, but Catholic theologians couldn't because theologians speak with a certain measure of authority in the church and for the church? The question would then could have been extended then if in fact his trespasses have to do with the core of Catholic identity. Why wasn't he defrocked and excommunicated as well? I mean, he's acting still in the name of the church as a priest. Okay. If the designation is only in terms of canonical mission, and this is another technical term which most people kind of miss, on what basis is that designation made? What seems to have happened is that the Vatican, in declaring Hans Kuhn no longer a Catholic theologian, in a sense was withdrawing his what we call canonical mission. Canonical mission meaning that there are certain Catholic theologians teaching in certain Catholic faculties of theology, which have a certain status, pontifical faculties. And they are appointed there not only by academic processes, but also there has to be at least tacit, if not explicit, ratification from the Vatican. Yes, we note that you are now in the faculty of this or that divinity school or seminary or what have you, or university. And because of the situation, as you know as well, better than I, many of you, in West Germany, there is a church-state relationship, Vatican relationship, and Concordats and all the rest, so that there are that there is a status, a kind of official status that King has there, or that most Catholic theologians that you'd be familiar with in this country, including the one who's standing up here, would not have. I don't have a canonical mission in that sense either. Boston College was the seminary I taught in, named after Pope John the 23rd. Just think, it was going to be originally named after Pope Pius the 10th. But John the 23rd was a favorite of Cardinal Cushing. But I taught at Pope John the 23rd. That was not a pontifical faculty. I taught for 10 years at Boston College. That's a Catholic university, but not a pontifical faculty, and not Notre Dame. Which is not a pontifical faculty, so that most theologians like myself don't have a canonical mission in that technical sense. So, but the question is that all they're withdrawing? It's not completely clear. Is that what they're withdrawing, the canonical mission? And on what basis is that designation made? In fact, how many Catholic theologians even have such a mission? Now, just as a footnote, there is something afoot now in the Vatican Congregation for Catholic Education. You probably read about this on occasion, new legislation regarding Catholic universities and colleges, and there are people over there who would like to bring all theologians under this umbrella so that they could all be, in a sense, under the technical restriction of a canonical mission, which could be withdrawn, which then could prejudice a person's situation in the academic environment. It just wouldn't work in the United States, and it's just a waste of time, even if they're, you know, harboring thoughts of doing it. It just wouldn't work, not with our... Yeah, you go over to one of those people and say, well, it wouldn't work with the AAUP. They say, AAUP, what is that? These people have no sense of legalities and academic protection. That's part and parcel of a country like this one. The document says that he is no longer a Catholic theologian, or at least has forfeited his canonical mission because of his views on papal infallibility, the magisterium, and the valid consecration of the Eucharist. But the emphasis is clearly on infallibility. Is the doctrine of papal infallibility, now I ask, so essential to Catholic identity that a rejection or even a criticism of it would be enough to put one outside the Catholic tradition? On what basis does the congregation say that Kuhn has, quote, departed from the integral truth of Catholic faith, unquote? Karl Rahner once referred to papal infallibility as a secondary, not a primary doctrine. This is not to say that he himself denies the doctrine. He doesn't. But there is, after all, a hierarchy of truths, as we are reminded in Vatican Council's, in the Second Vatican Council's Decree on Ecumenism, Article 11. But in fairness, I must quote the other side of that. In a letter to the West German hierarchy, May 15th, Pope John Paul II said as follows about this infallibility hierarchy of truths issue. I'm quoting, although the truth on infallibility of the Church can justly seem a less central truth and of a minor order in the hierarchy of truth revealed by God and professed by the Church, nevertheless, it is, in a certain way, the key to the very certainty in professing and proclaiming the faith for the life and behavior of believers. Weakening or destroying this fundamental base, the most elementary truths of our faith suddenly begin to collapse. Well, again, that's out of context, but the context isn't all that different from the excerpt. Anyone who's familiar even with the Lutheran Catholic dialogues now on infallibility, you know, knows that it's really an unrealistic statement of the case. I mean, even if one were a very conservative Orthodox Catholic, as was pointed out in one of the other lectures, the infallibility has not been used very much since it was defined in 1870. It was used once since 1870 to define the dogma of the Assumption, and I'm not just being frivolous here and trying to get laughs. I seriously make this point, but it ends up funny. I've described the use of the dogma of papal infallibility for the dogma of the Assumption as like a Nevada testing of the atomic bomb. Once it was defined, you had a lot of conservative Catholics who said, now the Pope's infallible and so forth, but they're just itching to see it used. And then in the meantime, you had a lot of Catholic theologians who then began to develop a doctrine what we call creeping infallibility or practical infallibility, so that even if a papal teaching were not strictly speaking consistent with the very precise conditions of the First Vatican Council, we must treat that teaching as if, for all practical purposes, as if it were infallible. And that's the doctrine of creeping infallibility or practical infallibility. And I think, in a sense, the dogma of the Assumption was, in a way, really, let's try it, see how it works. Because the dogma was not a dogma that was important to begin with. I have a section on this if you're interested, but on the Assumption and where it fits in ecumenically. The Lutheran Catholic Dialogue, the Catholic participants have some very useful observation in your Lutheran Catholic Dialogue document on the teaching authority of the Church and infallibility. So I recommend that very strongly, precisely on this point. So there, one can really ask whether the Pope is correct in saying that if we didn't have a papal infallibility or infallibility of the Church, infallibility only in the sense that we believe that the Spirit is so much with the Church, vivifying the dead bones and bringing them together, that if the issue really is an issue of fundamental identity of who we are as Christians and a fundamental fidelity to the transmission of the gospel, that in that moment when we come to terms with who is Jesus, as we did at Nicaea and Ephesus and Chalcedon, in those moments the Church is in fact protected by the Holy Spirit. And if that's what we can, if that's what we mean by infallibility, that is an immunity from fundamental error. At certain moments when our very identity is on the line, when the purity of the gospel is at stake, you know, then as your Lutheran brothers on the dialogue said, you know, from that point of view, yes, it makes sense in the context of our fidelity to the gospel, in the context of the very serious matter of proclaiming the gospel in a way that is faithful and that does not fundamentally corrupt it. But then it gets all mixed up with the papal infallibility and then certain dogmas which are obviously not central. So the issue is a bit confused, and I admit that, and I acknowledged that last night, and I said that's why I thought the Lutheran Catholic statement on the infallibility issue is not up to par in terms of what it did on the primacy. The Vatican text is itself exceedingly vague in its reference to King's views on Christology and Mariology, even though some Catholic theologians believe that King is more vulnerable in his Christology than on his ecclesiology. The congregation document is also confusing in its use of the words church and magisterium, and in its understanding of the relationship between theologians and the hierarchical magisterium. The noun church, as I said earlier, should always apply to the whole people of God unless otherwise restricted to a group within the church. But this document uses the unmodified noun church when it means the hierarchy. The two are not the same. In paragraph 5, for example, the document insists that a teacher of sacred doctrine must conform, quotes, to the thought of the church. Reading between the lines, the authors mean here the hierarchy, but they seem to assume an identity of hierarchy and church. The same problem applies to the document's use of the word magisterium. Teaching authority applies not only to the Pope and the bishops, which is the authentic magisterium, which means literally teaching authority rooted in pastoral office. Authentic doesn't mean as opposed to phony. Authentic is a technical term meaning it's a teaching office that is rooted in an it's teaching mission that is rooted in a particular teaching office. But this teaching authority is not only authentic magisterium, there's also a teaching authority that devolves upon the whole church in principle and to various competent members of the church and theologians. Finally, when the document insists that theological research and teaching should always be illumined with fidelity to the magisterium, it assumes that the hierarchical magisterium itself never changes, much less corrects its thinking and teaching. But it does and always has. If the Catholic Church had always followed the congregation's view, namely that theologians, their immediate responsibility is to, in a sense, draw their inspiration from the current teachings of the Pope and bishops, and to use their theological skills and gifts to better articulate and explain and defend those teachings. If that, in fact, had been the case, even in our recent history, there might have been no Second Vatican Council. We might still be thinking and teaching exactly as we thought and taught in the days, say, of Pope Pius XII. Rahner, Congar, de Lubach, Daniel Lou, John Courtney Murray, even Cardinal Bea. All might have been declared by these standards no longer a Catholic theologian in the 1940s and 1950s, because each in their own way took positions and even wrote positions that were in conflict with what was current then in terms of the what we call the ordinary magisterium. Now, as some of you who know the history know, that people like Rahner and Congar and John Courtney Murray were in fact forbidden to write anymore on certain subjects. But the fact of the matter is that they were able to transcend, and other theologians to transcend those prohibitions, and, if I may say, the spirit was stronger than the law in that case, and Vatican Council II happened, and the theology that had been, in fact, in ferment and had been developed, in spite of what you know the current ordinary magisterium was saying, did, in fact, inform the Second Vatican Council, and we moved to a new level of Catholic consciousness and Catholic life. Doctrinal development is a fact. It occurs because of antecedent theological development. But you cannot have theological development if theologians do little more than repeat, paraphrase, or do cautious commentaries on the present teachings of the hierarchy. The case against Hans Küng, then, is at least open to question. This conclusion does not assume that it is impossible for a Catholic theologian to become unorthodox, nor does it deny the right and the responsibility of pastoral ministers to exercise oversight over theological work in the church, nor finally does it excuse whatever might be objectionable in the manner and substance of King's own response to the various Vatican inquiries. It is a matter here in these first four questions of trying to sort out the relevant issues and principles. Now, the fifth and sixth questions having to do specifically with King's answer and then an answer I might give over against it. I refer now to two of Hans Küng's essays on which he directly addresses the question of Catholic identity, both written under the demand for some explanation of his position. One, after the recent censure, a piece that he did in the New York Times, January 28th of this year, which is also available as a postscript to his book, The Church Maintained in Truth. And the other was written after the infallibility controversy in 1971. Take the New York Times thing first. One of my friends, sympathetic with King and distressed, as many of us were, over the procedures employed against him, observed that the essay that Hans King wrote, namely, Why I Remain a Catholic, in the New York Times, that essay could just as easily have been written by someone like Professor George Williams, a distinguished Protestant church historian at Harvard Divinity School. I think my friend's comment generally accurate. I say generally because I am not at all sure that Professor Williams or very many other Protestant scholars would readily subscribe to King's declaration in that article, namely, that he has always acknowledged and defended the pastoral primacy of the bishops of Rome, linked to Peter, and the great Roman tradition as an element in Catholic tradition that is supported by the gospel, end of quote. But the basic point my friend made, I think, is well taken. There is a certain lack of specificity in the King piece, and it is not frivolous to ask why some Protestants could not also have written it, Why I Remain a Catholic. He insists that he is and wants to remain a Catholic, not only because he was born and raised as such, but because, as a theologian, he accepts and tries his best to follow the principle of Catholicity. For King, Catholicity has two aspects, temporal and spatial. Catholicity in time means that the church has been the church from the beginning with no historical gaps. Unlike what he calls Protestant radicals, the Catholic theologian does not leap from St. Paul to St. Augustine and then over the Middle Ages to Luther and Calvin, nor does the Catholic theologian ignore various doctrinal guideposts which have been erected through the course of centuries from biblical times to the present. Significantly, Kuhn concedes that there are Protestants, he calls them evangelical radicals, who are also Catholic in this temporal sense. Secondly, he says Catholicity is realized in space, and I quote, a theologian is Catholic if he is aware of being united with the Church of all nations and continents, he continues. He must therefore not orient himself only to the church of this country or to a national church, and will not isolate himself from the church as a whole, end of quote. Protestant particularism, on the other hand, and that's his term, tends to identify the church with a locally restricted community and is content with what he calls a theological provincialism. But Kuhn insists that there are evangelical Protestants who are also Catholic in this spatial sense, both spatially and temporally. Unfortunately, at least in my judgment, King never explicitly distinguishes between what he calls radically evangelical Protestants, who are, for him, also Catholics, and more traditionally evangelical Protestants, who are not Catholic in any meaningful sense of the word. I quote again, it is in this twofold sense, that is, Catholicity in space, Catholicity in time, that I want to be and remain a Catholic theologian, and to defend the truth of the Catholic faith in Catholic depth and breadth, he writes. And there is no doubt that a number of those who describe themselves as Protestant or evangelical can be and are, in fact, Catholic in this sense. End of quote. Now, if King means that many of his Protestant colleagues are no less Catholic than he, does he also mean that he is no more Catholic than they? And if so, isn't that just the point brought against him by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith? Nor does Kuhn appear to strengthen his case with his distinction between Catholicity as a principle of church life and theology and Catholicism as a hardening of the Catholic principle into institutional forms which corrupt this principle. He reproaches unevangelical Catholicism for being the defective opposite of unevangelical Protestantism, the former sins by excess, the latter by defect. If unevangelical Protestantism, he says, has accepted too little from the total Christian tradition and has made a one-sided selection from that whole, then unevangelical Catholicism has accepted too much. He calls it, and I quote, and this is typical of Kuhn, a syncretistic accumulation of heterogeneous, distorted, and occasionally unchristian pagan elements. That doesn't translate smoothly into Italian. These excesses of historic Catholicism, he argues, were responsible for the schism in the East and for the Reformation. And I quote him again, they represent the Catholicism about which the present controversy is being carried on in the name of the Catholicity of the Catholic Church. I suggest that King's distinction between Catholicity and Catholicism is open to the same kind of theological and doctrinal challenge that was brought against the classic Protestant distinction between the church as organism and the church as organization. For many Reformation Protestants, the true church was the invisible spiritual church. The institutional church was finite, sinful, and in no real sense the body of Christ. What such Protestants were denying, of course, is the radically and distinctively Catholic principle of sacramentality. For the Catholic tradition, the church is a sacrament, that is, a reality imbued with and capable of mediating the hidden presence of God. The whole church, the visible church, the institutional church, the people who make up the church. Catholicism, as the visible, institutional, culturally conditioned expression of Catholicity, is at the same time holy and sinful, but it is nonetheless the carrier of the divine presence. In not including any reference at all to sacramentality or to mediation in his otherwise eloquent and moving essay in the Times, Kuhn did not seem to be dealing directly enough with the question at hand. This is not the first time that Kuhn has faced the challenge of defining his Catholic identity, and neither is it the first time that he has given us too broad an answer. The earlier article to which I referred was called Why I Am Staying in the Church, appeared in the March 20th, 1971 issue of the America magazine. That's the Jesuit Weekly again. March 20, 1971. This was after the publication of his book, Infallible, an Inquiry, and all the arguments that followed the controversy after that. He formulated what he called his decisive answer in the following way. Now I'm quoting Hans Kuhn directly. And keep in mind what the question is. Why are you staying in the church with all this storm of controversy that you've created and all this animosity that you have evoked? I am staying in the church because I have been convinced by Jesus Christ and all that he stands for, and because the church community, despite all of its failures, pleads the cause of Jesus Christ and must continue to do so. And then the whole article concludes with this sentence: I am staying in the church because I am a Christian. And the word because is underlined. I mean, that answer could have been given. Why, if someone in the Presbyterian community was in trouble, why am I staying in the Presbyterian church? Why am I staying in the Methodist church? Why am I staying in the Lutheran church? I mean, that doesn't answer the question. In my contribution to the infallibility debate, which is published by Paulus Press in 1971, I suggested, you may recall that, it was four articles, one of which was done by a well-known Lutheran theologian, George Lindbeck of Yale. I suggested in that collection of four essays that the problem with the America essay of Hans Kuhn's is his apparent ambivalence about the fundamental question, why are you staying in the church? It is never clear in the article which church Kuhn is dealing with. Is it the whole body of Christ, Protestant, Anglican, Orthodox, as well as Catholic, or is it the Catholic Church alone within the total Christian community? He seems to have assumed throughout that essay that by answering the general question, why are you still a Christian, he was also answering the specific question, why are you still a Catholic? The America article, like the recent piece in the New York Times, was a truly moving account of his decision to reaffirm his affiliation with the body of Christ, because it is the body of Christ alone which in season and out of season confesses the lordship of Jesus and commits itself explicitly to the realization of the gospel among humankind. But the America article never really answered the question, why remain in the Catholic Church? Why not move to some other portion of the body of Christ where one no longer has to explain away the policies and attitudes of the Pope or the Curia, hundreds of bishops, or what he calls Roman legalism, centralism, and triumphalism in teaching morality and church discipline, to which he referred in that New York Times essay. I am certainly not suggesting here that Catholicism is identical with Romanism of this sort. But I suspect that King is making precisely that equation and so rejects both Romanism and Catholicism so defined. But there is more to Catholicism than legalism, centralism, and triumphalism. As Baptist theologian Langdon Gilkey, a colleague of Martin's at Chicago, argued in his Catholicism Confronts Modernity, a Protestant View, Seabury Press, 1975, Catholicism is a distinctive theological, doctrinal, aesthetic, liturgical, and spiritual tradition within the total Christian reality. Catholicism, he wrote, is marked by a commitment to certain historic values, community, tradition, grace, and sacrament. Indeed, he says, the Catholic principle of sacramentality, that is, that God is present in and through the visible, the finite, the tangible, the fleshly, the historical, the Catholic principle of sacramentality, now I'm quoting Gilkey, may provide the best entrance into a new synthesis of the Christian tradition with the vitalities as well as the relativities of contemporary existence, end of quote. By such standards as these, not everyone who believes in the Bible as the supreme criterion of all Christian truth qualifies automatically as a Catholic. To measure everything primarily, if not exclusively, against the biblical norm is a Protestant, not a Catholic, principle of theological and doctrinal interpretation. My conclusion here in this fifth question is not to place myself in agreement with the Vatican congregation on the King case. I wish only to suggest that King himself and those who do not think there is any case at all against him should provide better answers to the question of Catholic identity than they have provided so far. Finally, question six, what sort of answers? No theological principle or focus is more characteristic of Catholicism or more central to its identity than the principle of sacramentality. The Catholic vision sees God in and through all things, other people, communities, movements, events, places, objects, the world at large, the whole cosmos. And I must say, as Martin said the other night, you can't say everything in one talk. You might say it in two volumes, but not in one talk. This is all said with the understanding that the Catholic reality needs the Protestant principle always there to remind it that the sacramental principle always can go too far, and it's no longer God working in and through, but God identified with. And so you always have the temptation to idolatry. The Protestant principle, as Paul Tillich enunciated it, is that we have to be careful never to identify anything, any finite reality, with the divine. But he also acknowledged that there was Catholic substance that Protestants had lost, and that is to recognize that the divine is, in fact, present and works through the finite, and therefore the whole dimension of liturgy, of sacramentality, in a specific sense, has to be recovered, and in fact has been more than recovered in recent decades. The visible, the tangible, the fleshly, the finite, the historical, all these are actual or potential carriers of the divine presence. Indeed, it is only in and through these material realities that we can encounter the invisible God. The great sacrament of our encounter with God and of God's encounter with us is Jesus Christ. The church, in turn, is the sacrament of our encounter with Christ and of Christ's with us, church in that fullest sense. And the sacraments, in turn, are signs and instruments by which the ecclesial encounter with Christ is expressed, celebrated, and made effective for the glory of God and the salvation of humankind. A corollary of the principle of sacramentality is the principle of mediation. A sacrament not only signifies, it also causes what it signifies, a very traditional Tridentine statement. Thus, created realities not only contain, reflect, or embody the presence of God, they make that presence effective for those who avail themselves of these realities in faith. The universe of grace is a mediated reality, mediated principally by Christ and secondarily by the church and by other signs and instruments of salvation outside and beyond the church. Thirdly, Catholicism, beyond sacramentality and mediation, Catholicism has affirmed the principle of communion, that our way to God and God's way to us is not only a mediated way, but a communal way. And even when the divine human encounter is most personal and individual, it is still communal in that the encounter is made possible by the mediation of the community of faith. For example, there can be no purely individual relationship with God or Jesus Christ that is established and sustained by meditative reflection on sacred scripture, for example. For the Bible itself is the church's book and is the testimony of the church's original faith. And the church, in fact, made the judgment what in fact is part of the Bible and what is not. The mystic, even in the narrow sense of the word, relies on language, ideas, concepts, presuppositions when he or she enters into or reflects upon an intimate, contemplative relationship with God. We are radically social beings. Our use of language and our sexuality provide clear evidence of that. There is no relationship with God, however intense, however profound, however unique it seems, that can simply dispense with the communal context of every human relationship with God. And that is why, for Catholicism, the mystery of the Church has always had so significant a place in its theology, in its doctrine, in its pastoral practice, in its moral vision and commitment, and in its devotion. Catholics have always emphasized the place of the Church as both the sacrament of Christ, mediating salvation through sacraments, ministries, and other institutional elements and forms, and as the communion of saints, the preview or foretaste, as it were, of the perfect communion to which the whole of humankind is destined in the final kingdom of God. And so it is with the mystery of the Church that we come at last to the point at which a distinctively Catholic understanding and practice of Christian faith most clearly emerges. For here we find the convergence of those principles which have always been so characteristic of Catholicism, even when honored only in the breach: sacramentality, mediation, and communion. It has not been a question here in this presentation of arguing that the Catholic Church and the Catholic tradition are necessarily superior to all other churches and traditions on this point or that, but only that there is within Catholicism a configuration of values which one does not discover elsewhere and which commends Catholicism on its own merits without regard for competing configurations. In the end, Catholicism is not necessarily opposed to Catholicity. Catholicity is Catholicism's soul, and therefore must always be the measure of its integrity.